Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. There are four more weeks of the regular season in the NFL before the playoffs begin. It's been a trying year in many ways for the Packers, but fans of every team are bound to be at least somewhat disappointed in the end, unless their team wins the Super Bowl.
Philosopher Simon Critchley is a lifelong fan of what the rest of the world calls football and what we call soccer. And he's all too familiar with the fine line between dread and hope that all sports fans experience while watching their favorite teams.
In fact, that is one of the phenomena he writes about in his new book that analyzes sports, and soccer in particular, through the lens of philosophy. The book is called What We Think About When We Think About Soccer, and Simon Critchley joins us on the line from New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here, Mitch.
I want to start with a stipulation that we will probably use the term soccer in discussing the particular sport at the heart of your book,
right,
if only to avoid confusion for our Green Bay Packer supporting listeners here. Interestingly, before we go any further, you write that soccer and football actually were pretty interchangeable terms in England not that long ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's widely misunderstood as an Americanism by mainly by non-Americans, because football is seen as the, you know, the real name, soccer as some artificial name. But when I was growing up, I can remember on the radio and also reading magazines where soccer was the term that was used. And more importantly, soccer is called soccer because it's an abbreviation of association football, which is the proper name of the sport. And so soccer is actually truer to the name of football than football is. I'm happy that we're talking about soccer.
All right. I wonder if it was a little like that period where we were transitioning to the metric system in this country, and then it went away, much the way soccer has gone away as a term that's used in England.
Yeah, right. Yeah, probably. Yeah, so probably something similar. Yeah, but I think soccer is a good term because of that link to the social and the link to association, which for me is the heart of the game, is the experience of collaboration, of a group of players working together, and then fans working with the players, as it were.
Well, and I think we've sort of touched on this in just what you said there. This is what you see in soccer, then, that lends itself so well to exploring it through a philosopher's lens, then.
Yeah, I mean, it's first and foremost, it's just a, you know, it's a passion of mine. It's one of the few things that connects up my life from beginning to end, through particularly the support of a specific football team, Liverpool Football Club, but also just through watching the game, talking. That's what I talked about with my father largely, and it's largely what I talk about with my 25-year-old son. So football kind of joins up a life in that way. But philosophically, it's for me, one of the things that's interesting about football is the fact that it's not an individualistic sport. It's a collaborative sport. It's about the team. The one claim that I make early on in the book, which is kind of wish fulfillment on my part, is that the association of football leads to the idea that what's going on in football is an association of human beings, and that we could say that the form of football is a kind of socialism. Of maybe not of the Bernie Sanders variety, but some kind. And that's linked to me, and this is true of American sports too, that the fact that, in a different way, that the football teams all over Europe and South America and elsewhere are usually linked back to a boys' association, a club, a pub, or some kind of working people's association. So the links to football to a locality and to cooperation are very marked, and then the problem is with the riddle of football that I try and look at in the book is the connection between that and money, and that's a whole other topic.
Let me ask just for a basic definition here. Can you explain the concept of phenomenology and how you use it here?
Yeah. So I mean, what interests me in the phenomenology is what shows up. It's the description of experience as it's lived. It's as simple as that. So all phenomenology is the attempt to look at what's taking place and to find words to describe it. It's very simple. And in that sense, it's very similar to what a novelist does or a poet does. And so that's the approach. And the attempt is to describe the phenomenon of play, what's going on when we're looking at play. And I guess there are two mistakes I think we make when we think about play. The first mistake is to think that play can be explained by what's going on in the heads of the players or the heads of the coaches. And we listen to those endless interviews in every sport, but they seem to say nothing. And then the other mistake is that we can find an objective measure for football or any sport, soccer. We can find through data, through analytics, or through passes made, received, goals scored, and things like that. This gives us a kind of a truth to the game. So football, soccer could become a kind of science. And I think both those approaches miss the point. That when what interests me is the phenomenon of play, that when we're watching a game, we're kind of outside ourselves, we're kind of outside of our heads, engaged totally contemplatively with what's taking place on the pitch, and so the attempt through the book is to find a kind of middle course between a subjective approach and an objective approach, and that's what phenomenology offers for me.
What really jumped out at me and surprised me, actually, as you described it, both just in the last few seconds and as I read the book, I had a conversation not long ago, interestingly, with the comedian Lewis Black, we got to talking about his work in theater, and he talked in much the same terms about the alchemy or the magic of what goes on the stage in very similar terms, that this idea that, you know, objectively you're not in this place when you're acting out, you know, Death of a Salesman, you're not in this place, and yet the actors and the director and the audience, if all goes well, are in this place, much the way a soccer pitch is the substitute for a stage.
No, I think the analogy between football and football, soccer and, I keep saying
that's all right,
soccer and theater, I mean, the analogy between the two things is very, very close, and that interests me enormously. And actually, now I'm working on a book on tragedy, which is so much more about theatre. So, and what takes place in a theatre is that in a theatre we're looking at something, we're observing a phenomenon, what's happening on the stage, and if it's good, we're held out there, we're gripped by the spectacle that's taking place, and with soccer, something very similar happens. The spectators are completely engaged, caught up with the action that's taking place. I think that a soccer crowd is superior to a theatre crowd in the sense in which a soccer crowd is relaxed. They know what's going to happen. So, for example, I'll give you an example of what I mean. There's Bertolt Brecht, great German theatre writer and director. When he was trying to imagine an audience for his theatres in the 1920s, he said what he would like would be a sports crowd. And what he meant by that is that a sports crowd is relaxed, is confident in its views, and will engage with the action that's taking place. Doesn't sit back and kind of wonder, is this any good? What do I really think about this? Or, you know, or when we go to the theatre, we often kind of fall asleep because we're not sure what's happening. And so soccer kind of, and what interests me about, this is also true of baseball and other sports, there's a kind of an extraordinary knowledge on the parts of the fans as to what's taking place and the drama that's unfolding. So actually, you know, if you think back to ancient theatre, where there would have been, say, 15,000 to 18,000 people in the theatre of Dionysus in Athens, that's much closer to a sports crowd than it is to a contemporary theatre crowd, just the scale of it. So the stadia are theatrical. The spectacle that takes place is deeply theatrical, and so the two phenomena for me are very, very closely linked. Except I prefer soccer.
You just mentioned the idea of foreknowledge, and there's a really interesting aspect to this that I think people who are maybe not necessarily even soccer fans, but fans of anyone, I'll use the Red Sox as an example, but you could be a Packers fan or a Brewers fan or whatever and appreciate this thing that you write about, this poisonous cocktail of foreknowledge and hope.
Yes. Any sport is about losing. It has to be. You know, not everybody everybody can win. Only one team can win. So we know that. And it's not the losing that is the worst thing. It's the hope that keeps resurfacing, which is the worst thing. So even when you know that, you know, you're going to be disappointed that your team is not going to win, you still hope that they will. And that's the kind of the really cruel thing about sport. But also the interesting thing about it, it's the there's a kind of a foreknowledge on the part of the fans. And it's as if the players and the fans are caught up in a kind of web of fate. And it makes you think that this isn't really sport at all, governed by chance. It's much more like a shared fate that we have. And that's part of being a fan, it's sort of knowing ahead of time what's going to happen, and yet we still go along with it and we still hope. And there's something tragic about that, but important, I think. And also to communicate that to a subsequent generation, that get them used to not just failure, but the hope that tickles inside failure. And that's what it means to be a fan. If we won all the time, it would make no sense.
Well, and the number of times that I have turned to my own children and say, see, this is what it's about. This is what being a Red Sox fan is all about. You know, fill in the team here. And it's something that you really only get through the weight of years.
Yeah, the weight of years and the fact that the players come and go. I mean, the focus is, you know, always on the players, which is understandable. But the players come and go. The players in soccer are, you know, they're kind of mercenaries to some extent. There's some loyalty. There are players that stay with teams, but players can be bought and sold. And but the fans are a kind of living archive of the history of that club, whether it's the Boston Red Sox or Liverpool Football Club, and they know they're the kind of, as it were, repository of wisdom, and that's what really interests me. It's kind of fan culture, really. I like watching football, sure, but it's what goes on in the fans, between the fans, between rival fans, and the way in which that's linked to a deep sense of identity. That really interests me.
You do write about this sense of connectedness that soccer fans or football fans have with each other, even if they are fans of rival clubs.
Yeah, I think it's really important that football is a game which is it can be a violent, abusive game, but also a violent game, and that violence can be replicated in violence between rival sets of fans, and in particular in say in England in the 1970s and 80s, that was a huge problem, hooliganism, and that spread elsewhere. But there's a sense in which the interesting thing about soccer, and maybe sports in general for me, is you can have a deeply, deeply held commitment to a team, and you can know all about that team, and you can objectively hate the rival team. But you don't really hate them in the sense in which if you meet a fan of a rival team, you can still find things to talk about. And they can make their case to you, you can make their case to them, and you can even change your mind about things. And I've done this a lot with football fans from teams that I, you know, objectively kind of despise. But still, you know, you admire them. So there's a kind of, this takes us back to, directly to philosophy. Philosophy is meant to be the activity of reason and argument, which is meant to persuade and change people's minds. Except in philosophy, in my 30 years in teaching, I've never seen a philosopher change their mind about anything. They stick to their guns regardless. But in sport, there's a way in which people can change their mind. You can come up with an argument. You can have a conversation with a 10-year-old kid. Actually, very good to have conversations with 10-year-old kids about sports, and they can see something which you didn't see, and then suddenly your view of things has changed. And if only the rest of our lives were like that, I think it would be better. I think sport is a kind of interesting area of human activity. In politics, people stick, you know, dogmatically to their opinions. Perhaps that's understandable, but in sport, there's a kind of flexibility which is linked to this passionate loyalty. And it's those two things together which interest me. You know, to be a Red Sox fan is to be a Red Sox fan, is to live the history of that club. At the same time, at a certain point, you have to acknowledge that there are better teams, and there are better teams for good reason. And at that point, you change your mind, and you hope that your team changes and improves accordingly. Usually they don't.
No, exactly. There's one chapter I'm just intrigued by, and I feel almost compelled to ask you about it. The idea of the ball as an animate object. How do you see a soccer ball as being in some ways like a ventriloquist's dummy?
Yeah, I see. Well, in a sense in which we know the ventriloquist's dummy is just a dummy, and somebody's hand is up its back and making it speak. Yet when we watch a ventriloquist, we are. At that moment, we're taken with the idea that this dummy is actually alive and speaking to us. And so what I'm trying to talk about in that chapter is it's in soccer, it's not just, this is also true of baseball, it's not that the pitch, the playing field, the markings, the surfaces, the flags and the nets and all that are just dead objects. They're part of the life of the game. And, you know, I talk in the book about a very famous French footballer, Zinedine Zidane, mm-hmm. who manages Real Madrid now, and who talks about on one occasion, but probably more than one occasion, he had a kind of he could tell what the ball was thinking, right? The ball came to him, he could tell what the ball was thinking. He knew exactly what would happen. So, in a sense, to play a game is to play. With a ball, which is also alive when you're playing with it. And that's what I'm trying to... It's not that we just play with dead objects. Those objects are alive too. And there's a kind of... it's as if when we enter into the world of sport, we go back to a kind of animistic universe, you know, that what we think of as, you know, more ancient civilizations usually believed everything was alive, right? The mountains, sky, everything was part of the great circle of life. And we, in our wisdom, through science, have divested ourselves of that view. But in sports, it's still true. The whole thing is alive, and we engage with it, we live it, and those objects also take on meaning through that activity. And that's kind of really interesting.
So I have to ask, you are English, you live in New York. There is not a single mention, I don't think, of the MLS in this book.
No.
Do you think, is there something inherent in how other countries do soccer that makes this analysis more relevant to them? Or does the U.S. loss to Trinidad and Tobago substitute for any of England's collapses of the past?
It's comparable, but the U.S. national team has done remarkably well in World Cups in the last, since the 80s. I mean, it has punched well above its weight. It's had usually had, you know, two or three good players, but it's worked really well as a team. The physical level of the, you know, the physical fitness of the players is very high, and they're usually well educated as well. They're smart, maybe smarter than players from other places on the whole, because they usually got good at football in college and things like that. So that's all good. You've got the fact that the women's game is incredibly vibrant and powerful and played at a very high level in the US, three-time winners of the Women's World Cup, all of that. But there's something about will soccer, you know, be up there in decades to come with American football, baseball and basketball? I don't know, maybe. It hasn't really happened yet, and I don't know whether it's going to happen. And the reasons for that, I think, are... You know, they're partly to do with broadcasting rights and franchises and money and all of that. But it's also partly to do with, you know, kind of sporting habits that people have and these deep loyalties that people have to certain sports.
Well, I would say that I put this book in the category of another book that makes me really appreciate what I've been doing all these years as a sports fan. I really do appreciate it.
All right. Pleasure. That's great.
Philosopher Simon Critchley teaches at the New School for Social Research in New York. He's the author of books including The Book of Dead Philosophers and his latest, What We Think About When We Think About Soccer. We reached him on the line in New York.